The Daily Buzz on KCPW is sponsored in part by Sabra Hummus. Inspired by flavors from around the globe, Sabra's dips are handmade from fresh ingredients and spices. Sabra's mission is to bring healthy Middle Eastern cuisine to people's everyday diets. Online at sabra.com. The Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival is sponsored in part by Soyombo Mongolian Vodka, crafted in small batches at the original distillery site of the last emperor's palace in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Online at mongolianvodkas.com/soyombo.
It's the Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. This is Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center here on KCPW and kcpw.org, streaming at filmlink.com and as a podcast on iTunes. Coming up on today's show, the filmmakers behind This May Be the Last Time, Love is Strange, Dear White People, and producers Amy Hobby and Anne Hubble from Tangerine, a company that makes movies by women. Coming up after the news, we'll have our Hot Topics segment with Brooks Barnes from the New York Times, Brian Brooks from the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and Matt Kazanek, also from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. Coming up after the news. And day five at the Sundance Film Festival, The Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center for our Hot Topics segment. Our co-host for this segment, as always, Brian Brooks, my colleague at the Film Society.
Happy MLK Day.
Happy MLK Day here at Sundance. Next to Brian is his annual partner in crime for this segment. We try to do this at least once a year. Sitting next to Brian Brooks is Brooks Barnes from the New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being back.
Absolutely.
And also at the table, my colleague making his radio debut.
This is very exciting.
Mr. Matt Kazanek from the Film Society of Lincoln Center.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Cue the applause.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're over, you know, we survived the first weekend. We don't have the weather to complain about as we have in some years.
No. Sometimes that's good, though. It's like an all for one, one for all.
I know.
Like,
it's been kind of an easygoing, at least it seems like a very easygoing Sundance. It sort of eased through the weekend weather-wise. There haven't been, as of this moment, kind of an onslaught of deals. Sometimes there's like the kind of onslaught that hits sort of on Saturday night, Sunday morning. That hasn't quite happened. I don't know. What do you guys think? What are you taking away from this year's festival so far in the first weekend?
Well, there was one little deal. I mean, let's not trash on it too much. I mean, there was Zach Braff's film "Wish I Was Here," sold to Focus.
Has anybody here seen
this rehashed
film?
Focus.
I have, yeah.
Okay, now some people. I'm not going to make you answer.
I don't have opinions. I leave that to Manola Dorgas.
Okay, we can leave that to Manola. But some are saying it's the worst film of the festival. Is that true?
What's interesting is just the degree to which people are divided. Because
were you at the screening? The big
I was.
Yes.
Yeah,
so tell us about
and
that.
And the Kickstarter people that helped fund it, right, are just like over the moon. Mm-hmm. You know, standing, crying, and then the Variety review just like put the dagger in, and then that kind of sums up what I've heard privately from a fair amount of distributors, but Focus clearly saw something, you know, the 2.575 or something, and committed to a release on more than 500 or more screens. So, you know, that's definitely been one of the buzzier what to make of it movies.
And I guess in fairness to Zach Braff, I mean, there were folks who were just as sort of divided by Garden State, right? I mean, it has its fans and then it has its detractors. I don't know.
I think this is different, though. I think that with the whole Kickstarter thing, I mean, I think that people are kind of kind of going in like wanting to hate it, you know, if you're kind of against that. I mean, I personally was kind of very turned off by the Kickstarter thing, and he's doing his ad, and he's got this giant Garden State poster in his kitchen. I'm like, I hate this movie already.
What do you think about that, though? Like, if, you know, established, you know, seemingly probably wealthy filmmaker / actor, you know, someone who's been around the industry, who's going out to his fans and asking for donations, essentially, through the crowdsourcing Kickstarter, which is very, you know, which is a great mechanism for filmmakers generally, but for someone of Zach Braff's stature, What do you think about that?
What's the? I don't know enough about the back end, which is. So if I gave $1,000 to the movie, is it
you can
just charity?
I think you get an email from Zach Braff saying, yeah. here's a photo of me.
And let's not just
movie.
Trash on Zach Braff because others have been kind of doing
no,
it.
No, but I mean,
too.
I'm being hypocritical about it because I, I'm like, oh, screw Zach Braff, but I also gave money to Veronica Mars, so
okay.
I really can't speak with any, legitimacy when I'm criticizing people. But the difference is that I liked the other thing and I didn't like Garden State. So
right. So the Kickstarter people were all cheering yesterday, and then.
But someone else
gets the $2.75 million, I think.
Well, one of the interesting things about that movie, right, is that he said afterwards, that I wouldn't have been given Final Cut. I wouldn't have been able to keep these fantasy sequences in. Mm-hmm. And then with Kickstarter, he was able to do exactly what he wanted.
Correct.
And then afterwards, some of the distributors were saying, well, if he just didn't have those fantasy sequences. And so you hear that a lot about movies at Sundance, though. The whole thing about new voices and young directors trying to get their sea legs. But then I think that one of the reasons things aren't popping to the degree that perhaps they have before is because each movie has something wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're at least I'm not saying that I'm hearing that from the distributors.
Well, it's interesting that if we're talking about the business side and Matt books all the first run films for the Film Society in our theaters, so you're also dealing with a lot of the buyers and folks from the industry side. But picking up on the piece that you and Michael wrote in the Times, I guess it was last week or maybe more than that, but what it means to make a deal at Sundance is very different now. But how does that change the way that the New York Times, the way the industry, the way that we view the festival, and whether it's a success or not?
Right. Well, part of it has to do with what films they're picking. When Cooper took over 5 years ago, they did make a very significant shift back to the little, very indie type movie. But we were just struck by the fact that everything kind of sells now to somebody. Mm-hmm. It used to be that a sale was how you judged what was a success. But now with VOD, with Netflix, which I guess is VOD,
digital distribution,
everything, pretty much everything sells to someone, but the whether they're being seen in theaters to any degree more than just going there so they get a review and can be certified a movie is very different. I think that means something for Sundance, which, they make movies to be seen on big screens.
Yeah. And we've talked a lot, and we won't go into it as much on this segment because we've talked a lot about this, the Manola Dargis piece around this table over the course of the past week, and that's also that's a similar topic to look at from a different angle if you're a film critic, where the bar and where the bar is placed and whether theatrical actually means theatrical or whether theatrical is used to energize or promote a digital release.
Mm-hmm.
Can have a whole different impact.
Well, I think a lot of times it is. I mean, the way that I was sort of taught to do it, I think the old model is, that you have a full schedule, but, the number of calls that I get about people pitching films saying, they'll take anything and it's two shows a day and it doesn't need to be every day. I think they want the run, they want the review, and it's setting up other things.
As a booker, how do you feel about that? I mean, we've seen at Film Society it can work, but doesn't always work, right?
No, but I think that there are certain films where, I think that the models are changing, and I think that there are times where, you've got a worthwhile film that deserves to be seen by an audience, but maybe it doesn't need 30, 35 shows over the course of a week. And, if you give it, two or three shows a day, including a prime show, that might be enough, and just to set up all the other things that it wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
So what else? We've talked about Zach Braff. We talked about the industry.
We should mention Boyhood, which was of course, the big Albatross screening last night.
So what was the response to the new Linklater film? Anybody?
I've been hearing good so far. I kind of did like a quick, peruse through the reviews, but I've been hearing mostly positive. I don't know if...
This is a movie he's been working on for years, right?
I didn't see it, unfortunately. Yeah.
12 years.
12 years.
I think so, right. I mean, the amazing thing to me is just that you pick those kids. You're really making a bet that something's going to turn out, and it seems to, I haven't seen any of the critical response.
Anything happen to somebody on the way.
I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of Harry Potter-esque in that way.
But I guess that's just the same as a documentary when you've got these things where you're following these people's lives over the course of 5 or 6 years. It's the same thing. It's just different because it's,
I mean, there were like the obvious comparisons to Up, that documentary series where you follow those.
Yeah,
those
7
kids.
Up, 14 yeah. up.
But apparently, this is much
up.
More fuller experience. I don't, uh-huh. I haven't seen it, but apparently, like the reviews have been really good. So,
mm-hmm.
I guess we will hear it because IFC was always involved from the very beginning, so that's already placed.
The festival is doing something new this week. I think tomorrow, Tuesday, they're doing a surprise screening, a secret screening.
Yes.
That should be interesting at the Egyptian at 9 p.m., if I'm not mistaken. Yes. Any guesses on what that might
be? Is this their first secret screening?
I don't think they've done anything like this where they've announced it sort of on the Sunday before and saying, okay, we're not even...
There are a few secret things. I'm sure there's
secret
things. Something like, come see we're announcing our new movie with Lindsay Lohan. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, and I don't know. At a certain point, I think maybe I've been doing this too long. Then
get a little jaded.
The surprise announcement is kind of, I don't know, I've been on enough of the letdown of the surprises. Tell me a little bit what's happening before I get there.
Do you have any guesses on what it might be?
I couldn't imagine.
We were guessing, we were doing this yesterday. We came home from the show and we were having lunch. Uh-huh. And our big guesses were the opening film for Berlin, which is the Wes Anderson film, Grand Budapest Hotel, was our first guess. But then we also thought maybe it was part one of Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac.
Mm-hmm. I had heard Snowpiersir is
thrown. Well, they're saying it's a film by a major filmmaker.
Yeah.
Is it world major or Sundance major?
They didn't say.
Major,
yeah. The email that I saw didn't say American. It said a major filmmaker coming out later this year, which I guess technically could be next Friday. So it could be anything. Really.
So what else have you seen? What else have you been hearing? What are you sort of? What has sort of caught the attention of?
A lot
press
of people are
industry?
Talking about that movie, Dear White People. You know, I think
it's a very good film.
It's different than you might think. Yeah. You know, it has that really funny, grabby title, and then it gets fairly aggressive, I thought.
I agree with you. I was able to see it right before the festival. I think you probably did. You see it as well?
No, I didn't.
You saw it here?
I saw it yesterday.
It is. I think that, you know, the satire in the film is definitely... he's definitely playing with not only humor, but... the anger, the aggression in the film is sort of masked by humor and a satirical approach. But, I mean, you can almost see, like, you know, School Days and Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. You can see sort of, you know, I mean, but there's some real issues at work in the film as well.
And some great performances, actually.
How did it play in the audience?
What's the actress's name?
Oh, the main actress is so
the main actress is terrific.
We don't have it on this.
Even though I don't have opinions.
How hard is that? I mean, you have to you're not the critic, but you're here watching these films with for the first time with an audience.
I'm here to write about what people are responding to.
You're here to kind of soak in
deals, you know, try to see what we should pay attention to down the road. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We did a lot on 20 Years from Stardom last year, in part because what we saw here. So.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. How did Dear White People play with an audience here? I was curious.
It was an industry screening, so you can never entirely tell from, you know, the jaded crossed arms.
But when they do react, that's when it's something.
It was a big ovation on the P&I screening of Whiplash.
Really?
So, I mean, it was the first. It was the first screening. It was over, and it's just this rapturous applause. And this was P&I, so I was like, "Well, this is clearly a hit." So,
what else? We only have under a minute, and I'm wondering what else folks are looking forward to. What you're sort of watching the next couple days? Anything?
I was curious. Well, the Anne Hathaway movie is today.
That's today, right?
Song One. Is that what it's called?
Yes. I'm excited about it.
Directed by Michael Barker's daughter. He's the president of Sony Classics, co-president. And his daughter has
her debut, right?
Yeah, and she's blossomed into a really... I mean, I've seen her shorts.
Yeah, she
short
did. She had a short film that we had at Film Society in Lincoln Center, which
was a
really
new director's.
Good.
Very talented filmmaker.
I clued in that it was her at one point, but I didn't know at first, and it was really good. Yeah.
I think it will be really interesting. I've said this to my friends already, but I think it'll be really interesting if IFC picks up that film, and then you have Michael Barker's daughter making a film that's released by one of his,
Magnolia should go straight VOD.
Okay, I wasn't gonna go.
Or what about Classics? Can they buy it?
I would assume they can.
I know, but that will raise some questions too,
and it will raise some I'm sure heated discussions
at
the dinner table
in Hollywood. Absolutely,
I'm sure it'll lead to some really interesting conversations at the dinner table. If you know things are going well or not going well.
Right. Why aren't those ads playing?
Our guests for Hot Topics on day 5 have been my colleagues Matt Kazanek and Brian Brooks from the Film Society and Brooks Barnes from the New York Times.
Thank you.
And it's the Daily Buzz on KCPW. Sundance 2014. Across the table from a filmmaker who has a film called This May Be the Last Time. His name is Sterling Harjo. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent.
So this is, we're going to dive right in. We have just under 8 minutes
okay.
To talk about your movie. And the film, which we'll talk about and I want you to describe in a moment, is personal to you because it's about your own family. Mm-hmm. It's about your own grandfather. Tell us a little bit about the movie, but also I'd like to hear about any challenges you might have faced in deciding to explore such a personal story. What made you want to tell this story?
So it started out as not a personal story. It started out as a movie about just these songs that I wanted to tell a story about. And it's songs that I grew up hearing in my community.
Tell us about them.
They're actually Christian hymns that the Muscogee Creek and Seminole people sort of adapted and changed into their own thing. And they're influenced by Scottish missionary songs, mm-hmm. and also slave spirituals. And so they sort of have that kind of bluesy feel to it. They're all mm-hmm. a cappella. They're just really unique songs. And I wanted to tell a story about these songs. And so in doing that, there was a story that I heard all the time growing up about my grandfather and the day he wrecked off of a bridge and they couldn't find his body. And so people searched for him. People camped out and searched for him for like a week.
In the early 60s.
Yeah, 1962. And they sang these songs while they were searching for him. So I wanted to put that in the film. But as I was making the film, all of these people that I was interviewing about the songs, it turned out that they were there. So it just became this bigger part of the story, story of my grandfather. So...
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the filmmaking process. This documentary, as you mentioned, explores not only the people, but the music itself. Tell me about shooting it. Tell me about working within the community to make the movie. Tell me about the support you had to sort of enlist in order to tell this story as sort of in such an open way as you did.
You know, I scheduled the whole film myself, interviews and everything. Uh-huh. But instead of like, it was just, I knew that the approach to making this film was going to have to be different because, you know, I'm dealing with people from my community and you just do things differently. And so I moved back home and it was really just word of mouth. I was like, I'm making a film about these songs. So anyone that was really interested in talking, like I sort of found them or someone suggested them to me.
Word of mouth.
Yeah, it was sort of a word of mouth scheduling. And, you know, I really lucked out with some of the characters that I found and some of the amazing singers. It sort of felt like Alan Lomax going down to the, you know, Mississippi and capturing some of these singers for the first time, you know, or the last time even, or, you know, trying to preserve some of these songs. So,
well, it's in the title, This May Be the Last Time, because this music is the people that are doing this and the music itself is kind of fading away, or you're hoping that it won't.
Yeah, I mean that's the idea, and you know the title of the song means a lot. I think it there's the obvious thing of like this may be the last time these songs are sung, you know, and we need to save them, but also there's a song called This May Be the Last Time, and in our language it's espogades omis kithiskos, and it translates to This May Be the Last Time We Don't Know, which actually you can trace that song, and there's a slave spiritual song with the exact same lyrics. There's blues adaptations of it. The Staple Singers have a hit with the same song in 1960 something, and then in the 60s. And then the Rolling Stones have a song called The Last Time where and the lyrics are, this may be the last time we don't know or whatever.
Yeah.
But the Muscogee Creek version is still the same. It's, you know, as it's always been, this may be the last time
we don't know. It keeps getting reworked.
So really it's the title sort of means a lot. It sort of also is the title of a song that just shows the influence in history and music history that these songs have.
You talk about home being Oklahoma for you. You're a member of two tribes in mm-hmm. Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Tell me about family and tell me about how your family felt about you exploring what ended up being a broader story, but mm-hmm. you exploring your grandfather's story. It must be hard in some ways for especially older folks to mm-hmm. sort of talk about this or still talk about it. It must be emotional.
It's weird because for me, like, it's a story that I loved growing up, but I think because I just heard it from my grandmother all the time,
right.
I never realized, you know, it never hit me that it was a real thing.
Right.
You know, it was just a story that I heard, but making the film made it very real to me.
Right.
And you realize that, oh, there's all these people that it affected and there's these people that were there. And this guy's uncle, like, was the one who came up with the idea to dam the river that actually, you know, it's like all of these things kind of start coming together. And then you realize that it's a real event that happened and someone really passed away, someone that I didn't know, but it affected my whole family forever, you know?
Yeah.
And my dad said something to me the other day that was really, you know, kind of really made me feel good about making the film, because he never knew him. He was five when this happened. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, because he was like, I'm really glad you made this film because it made me feel like I got to know my dad, you know, more. And wow. That's really something huge for someone to say, you know, because I know it affects him, you know, like I know that it affects him that he didn't know his father. But just to hear him say that was pretty amazing. And you know, like my grandma's in the film and she's really excited to see it, but she doesn't want to like watch it with the audience. And, you know, you just see that it's real. It's real. It's a real event that happened and it affected a lot of people. So,
well, you're certainly no stranger to Sundance. You've had a couple of films here in the past.
Yeah.
This festival can obviously cast a huge spotlight on a film. Mm-hmm. What do you hope the impact of this film will be? We have just under 2 minutes left. Yeah. What do you hope the impact of this film will be going forward?
You know, I just really think it's a film that I'm not worried about people liking it. Like, I know that they'll like it if they come see the film, you know?
The music is such a strong hook. That's what I took away from it.
Yeah, and people get emotional with it, and people really you know, it's like going to church. Even if you're not religious, you're still going to feel something in the room watching the film. So I'm just really excited to see as many people watch it as they can, you know, and I just would like to get it out there. Usually, you know, when I've been here with other films, maybe because I wrote and directed them and it was less of a documentary, but this is more personal, so I don't know. But this film, I'm less nervous about everything.
Really?
You know?
Yeah. You seem very calm about it.
For some reason, it's just like, well, if you don't like it, I don't know, like, you need to go to the mountain and pray or something. I don't know. Like, figure yourself out or something. But so it doesn't really stress me out too much.
Well, the film is playing throughout the week. There are screenings on Tuesday, Wednesday, later in the week, next weekend. The film is called This May Be the Last Time. The director is Sterling Harjo. 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
If people want to find out more about the movie, there's a website.
This may be the last time film.com.
This may be the last time film.com. On this fifth edition of the Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez, 2014 Sundance Film Festival, seated across the table here at the Million Square Foot Lounge on Main Street from Justin Simeon. Welcome.
Hey, man. Good to be here.
Dear white people.
Yeah, that's right.
One of my highlights of the festival.
Oh,
congratulations.
Thanks. Thank you so
much. I was
much.
Able to see it before the festival.
Oh, cool.
To prepare for this interview.
Very cool.
But I heard you had a terrific screening. Yeah. Terrific first screening on Saturday night.
Really great first screening. Even better second screening at Temple on Sunday. You know, the Q&A was just people standing up and just vomiting love, projectile vomiting love at us and the cast. And that was a crazy, amazing experience.
If an audience is going to projectile vomit, you want it to be love.
You want it to be love as opposed to hate and, you know, indifference. That's even worse.
I guess with this movie, because of the approach that you're taking, and we'll talk about that in a second, were you unsure of how an audience would respond to it, let alone an audience at a festival like this, which is so, you know, seasoned and hardened in industry?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also a very open audience here, I find.
Totally. And you know, this is my first time up here, so I really didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
I just tried to, you know, sort of live by what I always say is that you kind of have to be honest, try to tell the truth and do something that is authentic. And that's what I tried to do with the film. And I tried to make a movie that I wanted to see and something that I would kind of get my life from. And hopefully there are just more people like me. And it seems to be warmly received by black folks, white folks, anybody who understands what it feels like to be an other at some point in their lives.
It's the story of black students at an Ivy League college. That's and right. They are definitely an other, but they also have each other.
Yes, it's
in
true.
This college. As a way of telling the audience that's listening a bit about the movie, can you describe a little bit about where the idea for the film came from?
Sure. So it really started in my college experience. You know, I went to a PWI, which is a predominantly white institution, and
Chapman
University,
Southern California.
Fantastic film school, but a total culture shock for me coming from Houston, Texas, going up through the magnet programs, and you know, my friends were like a Benetton ad. So I go to Chapman, and I'm the only black person for miles, you know, and
literally,
you know, and just for and even the favorable assumptions that people had about me, and maybe the not so favorable ones, it just I always found myself kind of toggling between the worlds of my white friends, my black friends. Right. You know, there's a version of me that went to class. There's a version of me that, you know, worked on the newspaper. There's all these different versions of me. And that's really what the first, the first draft of it that I wrote in 2007, that's really what that was. It was just kind of anecdotes from, you know, my life and from my friends' lives. Mm-hmm. And as it became Dear White People over over the years. I thought it, you know, it's a good sort of microcosm, this college setting, for what I think is kind of the new black experience. You know, most black people that I know have to sort of toggle and modulate between all sorts of different worlds and through all kinds of assumptions about what and who they are.
Right. You know? So let's talk about the approach, because you can... One can get away with a lot and say a lot through satire, and you're having fun on the screen, and you're presenting a message in a way that's very digestible, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Cool.
But just below the surface, there's some real issues being explored.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk specifically about this issue of these shocking to me parties on college campuses where everybody pretends to be black?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, it's a phenomenon that happens every year all over the country in prestigious, you know, colleges, not so prestigious, and sometimes they make the news, but not always.
Yeah, we see the photos at the very end of the movie.
Absolutely, and there's some even worse ones that, you know, we can't use.
And I went to UCLA, and I remember and this was a long time ago in the 80s. But I remember, I think my first week there was a fraternity that was in trouble for having a party that was very discriminatory towards Latinos.
Oh,
you know, people throwing tortillas at the, you know, I mean, it was just like crazy.
No, it happened. Yeah, to all the different groups of people, frankly, it happens at these places. And what was really interesting to me to do was to tell a story about your identity versus who you really are. Okay. And for me, black identity, whatever that even means, is very much informed by you know, culture, the culture that we all kind of consume, black or white. And what was really interesting to me when I started to sort of research these blackface parties and how they happened is that it wasn't people just being racist or malicious. Like, it didn't come necessarily from a malicious place. That's what they thought it being black was. Sometimes they think they're celebrating it when they do it, you know? Sometimes they think that they're just having fun, but because sort of these images of black people are kind of served up as entertainment and for public consumption, you know?
Hip-hop culture,
there's this sort of gang culture, whatever it may be. There is this sort of, like, you know, mass ownership by people that they really don't know how offensive it actually is. And so what I wanted to do is really sort of bring that conflict between how you're perceived and who you are to a head in the most dramatic way I could think of. And just in doing the research, that's the thing that kept coming up. There was actually, in the original script, there was a sort of blackface party that I thought I was just sort of being outrageous about. And then I actually took it out of the script for a while.
Really?
And then this, you know, this news story came out that it happened at UCLA, San Diego. No, I'm sorry. UC San Diego. A Compton cookout thrown by a white fraternity, you know, where people literally came in blackface. And there was this really horrible, egregiously, you know, racist Facebook invite that went out. And they went and found, like, this, like, local rapper to sort of, like, own the party, you know, say that he threw it to sort of get out of trouble. And it was fascinating because it was really happening, you know. And just the week when we started shooting, I think it happened at Dartmouth, like the week we started shooting, a very similar event happened. So it's crazy. And obviously there are other, you know, more famous and viral cases that have happened just last year.
Right. Switching gears for a moment, your background is, you've worked in film, in the film industry for a while. I met you when you were working at Paramount.
That's right.
PR department,
That's
maybe.
That's right, yeah.
But you've also worked at Participant.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. How has your work in the film community and in the film industry informed your view, your views, and sort of your approach to this film?
I think it definitely, like, helped in terms of trying to get noise. You know, I think that it's very hard to make any kind of movie, tell any kind of story, you know, with us, even on the low budget end of it, it's very difficult to get a movie off the ground. It's real, real hard to get a black movie off the ground, especially if it's, you know, not a straightforward drama or something that comes in a familiar package. Mm-hmm. So I really just tried to employ as much as I could to galvanize an audience to get excited about the idea, even if there wasn't necessarily a movie for them to come see. And, you know, one of the first things that where it started to spark in me is I started the Twitter account Dear White People to sort of work out the voice of one of the lead characters, Sam White, and just to see how people would react to her, her approach to, you know, race relations, if I could say that. And And that kind of developed in, you know, it developed its own little small following. And then when it came time, you know, when I felt like the script was ready for people to read it, you know, put all my tax return money into a concept trailer and put it on YouTube and reached out to those same people.
And
that took off in a really big way for me and for the film. And I knew to do those things because of, you know, this PR background that I had. And I knew to give people a call to action. And mine happened to be, give me some money, please, 'cause I ain't got none. And they did, you know. They really helped us get through our pre-production. So,
who are some of your personal filmmaking influences?
Well, you know, I think Stanley Kubrick is probably at the top of my list. Right. You know, Spike Lee is a huge influence, but so is Ingmar Bergman and Fellini.
Yeah,
you know, I'm a total like film snob when it comes to the movies that I watch over and over again. I'm on a big Fosse kick right now.
Oh yeah,
yeah. You know, the biography just came out. I think everybody's reading it and rewatching all of those films. Yeah. So you know, I've watched all that jazz. I don't know how many times in the last 2 weeks, but...
Oh, good idea. I'll come back and watch that.
Yeah.
Folks have obviously mentioned, or have definitely mentioned to me in talking about the film this weekend, the connection to Spike Lee. Mm. Most specifically, Do the Right Thing and School Days. Those are sort of the most obvious films if you're going to talk about Spike's work and how it might connect to this.
Sure.
Did you watch any particular films, whether by Spike or by any other filmmakers, as you were trying to determine your own sort of voice and look and feel for the film?
You know what? I watched every ensemble movie I could get my hands on. Any movie that dealt with more than one protagonist.
Yeah.
You know,
what were some good examples? What were ones that you sort of...
Election really is just one of my favorite movies of all time. I watched that a bunch to see how it worked. Even things that are really broad, like Animal House, I watched a few times. Of course, Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
Fame is one. School Days, of course. Yeah. Royal Tenenbaums. I mean, like, you know, anything that was operating, whatever genre it was marketed as. Yeah. Network is a huge influence on me.
Network's great.
Anything that sort of toggled between these different stories, I really tried to figure out what made them work and what made them tick and what they kind of got to get away with.
Yeah.
In terms of social commentary and conversation that maybe is non-traditional for a film because of the way they were structured. And, you know, just tried to pour all of that information into the way the screenplay was written.
In what ways do you feel like you got to get away with things that you might not have expected
I think what's really fun in a multi-protagonist story is because you are sort of juggling all of these different threads, you really do get to kind of live in the characters' conversations a little bit more.
Right.
You know, because the plot sort of, because you're toggling between all these different plots, the plot kind of has to stay at a certain, it really can't get terribly complex because then you can't really follow all of these people.
Yeah.
And what that does is it really lets you kind of like live in their lives and hear what they have to say and get into their, you know, their motivations, you know, maybe with a slightly, you know, less complicated plot line.
The film is called Dear White People. It's one of my favorites of this year's 2014 Sundance Film Festival. The director is Justin Simien. The film's playing again on Thursday night at the Eccles. Thursday afternoon at the Eccles, Friday at Tower in Salt Lake City, and on Saturday at the Prospector here in Park City.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thanks so much, man.
Yeah,
excited to be here. Yeah.
Continuing on the Daily Buzz, here at the Sundance Film Festival, Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. We have a crowded table, and it's worthwhile because it's a terrific movie that played on the first weekend of Sundance. It's called Love is Strange. And the filmmaker is sitting across from me, Ira Sachs. Welcome.
Hi, Eugene. So nice
and
to be here.
We have a group of amazing actors who've performed so well in this movie. To my right, Marissa Tomei. Welcome.
Hi, Eugene.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
To my left, Mr. Darren Burroughs. Welcome.
Hello, Eugene.
And across from me, the two leads of the film, the lead characters in the film, lead actors in the film, play the lead characters. I want to welcome Mr. John Lithgow and Mr. Alfred Molina.
Thank you. Thank
sharing
you.
A microphone.
Nice.
Sorry to make you share this microphone.
They share a bed in the film.
Quite
so
apt.
If you can share a bed in the film, you can share a microphone.
And a bunk bed at that.
That's right. Let me start with Ira, because this movie is set in a particular moment, in a particular city, at a particular time. Everything feels very particular, I guess, is the word I keep using, and because it, the specificity of the moment in which this story is captured, to me, is what's particularly resonant about it, maybe because I'm a New Yorker.
Right.
Tell me about where this came from.
I've been in New York for 25 years, and I wanted to make a love letter to the city. And I think that's because I've found that my life, both in the ups and downs, it's been very much supported by a family of people who've come together. And I think in New York, particularly, there is a way in which our friends and our neighbors become our strength in lots of ways. I also am in a relationship now, a marriage that is gives me some hope for what a long relationship might look like. And I wanted to make a film which projects what that might feel like 30 years down the road, mm-hmm. if it's a love that blossoms instead of one that destroys.
As the movie begins, our two lead characters are on their way to City Hall to get married, or on their way, I should say, to their wedding. Not City Hall, but they're on their way to their wedding. This is the start of what becomes a story that explores the challenges that their relationship will face, very direct challenges, as the movie goes on. Tell me about each of your characters. For those who are listening and hearing about this movie for the first time, Love is Strange, tell me about John, tell me about your character. And he's all gussied up at the beginning of the movie with his bow tie.
Yes, I'm Ben, and Fred is George. I'm a good but not successful painter, and he is a music teacher at a Catholic school. And we've been together as a couple, married in everything but the name, for 40 years. And yes, in the first scene, we're preparing for our wedding. Two old men preparing for a wedding, which is quite a unique scene. I don't think I've ever seen that in a movie or play or...
And of course, it being New York, you can't find a cab.
To save your life, you can't find a cab. And we're under that particular stress of being late and not able to get to an important event, except it's our wedding and we're in our 60s. It's, in my case, my 70s. But we have all the behaviors of a very comfortable, familiar, long commitment marriage, including all the crabbiness and crankiness. Other's sentences, knowing where the other is going to come through and where the other is going to let me down again. You know, it's a marriage. People say we play two parts. We play one part, and that part is a marriage.
What drew you to these, Alfred Molina, what drew you to this character? And John can jump in at any point and tell him about the same. But
it was just the script, and I remember when I read it, I think I got to page 20, and I thought, oh, I think I've got to do this, because it somehow reminded me of me, because the full character's name is George Garea. He clearly has some kind of Hispanic background. I do too. So first there was that. Then Ira had this idea. He wanted the character to be British. You know, he just thought it'd be a nice kind of little flavor to add to the mix, and that enhanced my connection with it. But it was something about the relationship, the way it's depicted in the movie, reminded me of my own marriage, in the sense that, you know, when I've been married for 30 years, and you know, my wife and I behave in the way that George and Ben behave, and strangely, not strangely, but that, you know, coincidentally, when we, John and I talked about it while we were filming, he was saying, yeah, that's right, yeah, it's like with Mary and me. I mean, the same kind of, and that's, I think that's the important thing about the movie, that it's not about a gay marriage as much as it is about marriage. And what happens over a long relationship, and what's so dense and layered about the movie as well, is that we're looking at, in a sense, three different stages in people's lives in terms of how they learn about relationships. We're at the end. Marissa and Darren's characters are kind of in the middle, mm-hmm. and then you have this fantastic presence of this young boy, this young teenage boy played by Charlie, who is at the beginning, just beginning to discover what it means to have relationships, how to recognize them, how to nurture them, and so on. And I think that gives the whole thing, made it feel so universal to me, mm-hmm. which I think was a big part of the appeal.
One of the things I'm remembering, I'm just going to pipe in, is Fred is talking about the characters and how they're sort of, in certain ways, like certain ways about him. But, I, you know, the script, for me, is always a blueprint, and the process of actually getting to the production stage is a process of learning what these people that I've cast, because I don't cast actors, really, I cast people, and that's who's in the film, and a lot of rewriting and shaping was built around all four of these people, and mm-hmm. conversations came into the making, and certain details and precision of character that you talk about, mm-hmm. I feel like comes in the final stage when you begin to hand the script over, the story over to the characters. Mm-hmm.
I love what Alfred Molina is saying about relationships at different stages, because I was thinking about that as I was watching the movie and as I was reflecting on it this morning. I'm looking at Darren and Marissa, and there's a whole other relationship playing out with your characters, and then there's obviously this relationship with the younger folks in the movie. All of this is happening at a time that the relationship between John and Alfred Molina is so... There's an intensity around this issue of gay marriage at this particular moment. And I wonder how Marissa and Darren, you looked at sort of the relationship that, or the role that your own relationship would play in the movie as a way to reflect
as a counterpoint
that.
Or a reflection.
It's kind of a foil in a way to that.
Well, it was kind of like our hetero marriage sucked. But it's really less that. It was just more about the stages, ultimately. I feel like ours was in this middle stage that was more difficult to, and were we going to be able to continue together and keep it knit together? And but we always disagreed, Darren and I. I kept saying, there's a problem in this marriage, and he kept saying, we're fine.
We're fine.
So I guess that's the way that that it, you know, would be.
And I think there's a moment where John and Fred speak to that in the scene in the bar where John confesses his past indiscretions, and they speak about them as that was a moment in their life when they were in the middle of their relationship. And I think, in my opinion, that the film really succeeds if it's as Fred spoke to. It's about marriages. It's about relationships. It's about human beings. Even though it certainly is at a what's the word? Appropriate? Not appropriate.
Timely.
Timely.
But it's also kinds of love or dimensions of love. Like I feel like my character or our marriage wasn't ever going to have the robust, full-bodied nature that their marriage had. That's just not the nature of our love and our relationship. Mm. I just don't feel like it was ever going to... I feel like when I see how much that George needs Ben and shows up at the house, that it's just... It's crushing, shocking in a way. Like, we don't have that, or we don't have that anymore, or we don't have that, whichever. It's in the eyes of the beholder. But, oh, I'm not going to be needed like that, I guess.
What a great place to premiere this movie. My God, people are so hungry and receptive for this kind of work. It's just great.
And it's worth mentioning, and we'll go a tiny bit longer than we hoped, but... I'm sorry to draw such a direct parallel to what's happening in Utah now, but obviously what's happening with same-sex marriage around this country and happening in particular in this state right now, and anybody can jump in on this, but you can't talk about this movie and the variety of relationships that it portrays without talking about the political moment we're in
right
now,
that
the social
moment. As a filmmaker, you try to tell narratives that are human and real and that are universal, but in fact, what you're doing is presenting your viewpoint of the world. And I think for me, this film has a great chance to have impact because it is a very... accessible way to make familiar relationships that some people believe falsely are unfamiliar. Right. And I think there is an intimacy that I see the audience gets with the relationship of Ben and George, right, which is if they are their uncle and his partner. And I think that is where you make change, really.
Yeah.
It's very true. I mean, we didn't set out to make a film for a niche audience. We didn't want to preach to the converted. We didn't want to preach at all. But we have made this film with the full acknowledgement that half the population is still uncomfortable with the notion of marriage equality. The law is racing ahead of society, and society is catching up. What makes us feel so good about this film is that it simply presents this as a given, as something acceptable. The fact that relationships like this not only exist, but are going to now exist with greater acceptance. And if we've done something to just nudge that consciousness along a little bit, it just makes us feel even better about making such a fine film.
And I think we all know that's what art can do and has done in the civil rights movement. It was certainly a part of the what people were seeing in plays and theater and film were changing the country. So let's hope we're doing some of that.
The film is Love is Strange. The director is Ira Sachs, And the terrific cast, Darren Burroughs, Marissa Tomei, John Lithgow from Molina, thank you for being here today. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And wrapping up this edition of the Daily Buzz on KCPW, filmlink.com, and iTunes, seated across the table for our Industry Insider segment with two producers who have a new company called Tangerine. It's actually launched a year ago here at Sundance. Amy Hobby and Ann Hubble, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hub and Hob.
Hub Hob.
Yep.
let's talk about Sundance first of all. Mm-hmm. How many years have each of you been coming to this festival?
Oh, come on. Nobody needs to know how old I am.
You were four when you...
I was. Well, you and I came in
pre-kindergarten, pre-K.
20 straight years for me.
I've been here on and off. I've had like 9 films here, 9 or 10, and won the grand prize with films twice.
Congratulations.
So fewer years than Hub, but some prestigious years for me.
Tell us about Tangerine.
So,
this is Ann Hubble.
Tangerine is our new production company and community builder for films by women directors. So we're focusing mainly on narrative films. Mm-hmm. And we also have some community partnerships with MoMA and a couple of grassroots organizations. And the idea is just to spread the word about needing more women filmmakers and empower women. And
mentorship. We have mentorship programs, awards for women directors at festivals around the country.
Yeah, we have a donation-based, crowdsourced fund called the Juice Fund, where we award, you know, $1,000 to first or second time narrative women directors.
So the two of you have worked together as producers, in particular on a film called Gaby, which played the festival circuit and got released and had a really nice run. But in the case of this company, in case of Tangerine, tell me about the conversations the two of you had that led to the creation of this company. Why was it necessary? Why was it necessary now? And what did you feel like you could bring to it, the two of you, in this kind of collaboration together?
You want to tell the backstory, Ann?
Origin story.
Yeah, the origin story.
The Tangerine origin story.
So the seed was planted. We had wanted to start a company together. We'd known each other in the industry for a long time and both wanted to have a company and have a company that had a brand and kind of work towards something that we could build. And we'd been talking about it for years. And then maybe 3 years ago, we really sat down and said, let's knock out this business plan and think about ways that we can be different than sort of the regular, let's, you know, produce one movie and raise money for it at a time, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And we both realized that we wanted to do something that we believed in terms of what kind of films we were making. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to be stuck with, you know, just one kind of movie. And so it was important to both of us at this point in our careers and as women and in the industry to help other women and to not limit ourselves in terms of subject matter.
Mm-hmm. The day you came in to the office was you had been working on a political campaign.
Yeah, I had been working with Kirsten Gillibrand's campaign in New York. So I was like fired up. And I walked in and I said, you know, we really have to work with more women. And once we looked at the statistics,
let's Google how many women directors there are.
Yeah.
And we were like, what? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And it's been the same year after year. Last year, the statistics just came out. I guess 6% of the top films released, the 250 top films released last year were directed by women. That's
6%.
It. 6%, down from the year before, 9%.
But I don't think it's ever gone over 10%.
Yeah, ever.
It's surprising because you think, you know,
it's
we're
the same
here
as airline pilots. Yeah, same statistics as women airline pilots.
that's our next gig. We're going to take over the aviation industry.
Tangerine Air.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That would look great.
Stick a pin in that. Very nice. Fly Tangerine. We knew that it was bad, but we just didn't have an idea that it was that bad, really.
You launched the company a year ago here at Sundance. Tell me about the past year. Tell me about what has happened in the creative community. What kind of response have you had? I know that people are talking about the company. You must have a pile. I know you have piles of scripts, right? I mean,
the electronic pile is very big. The
electronic pile is 100 feet high.
Thankfully, yeah. Great, which is great.
Yeah, no, it's great.
There's a need, obviously.
There's obviously a need. We had an overwhelming response. We had no idea how overwhelming the response would be.
Yeah.
you know, we've been meeting with women directors, talking about projects, working, producing, meeting with financiers. It's been a crazy busy year. We have a series we've been doing with MoMA mm-hmm. in New York.
Tell us about this screening series, because it's really yeah. fun and there's a cool concept to it.
So about once a quarter, we try to do something with MoMA. Over the summer, we released a film with them in New York for a week-long run called La Coquillette. And, you know, through social media and, you know, networking, we were able to get a really good audience there for the film. And it's a very fun movie by a woman director about women filmmakers. And so that was great. And then just 2 weeks ago, we did a screening of the Sarah Polley doc, which we think is fantastic. Stories we tell.
Yeah.
And Sarah came and did a Q&A. And right before that screening, we actually got about 20 women filmmakers in New York together and had cocktails and made tangerinis, which are our signature drink.
Yeah, signature cocktail.
Yeah.
It's vodka with
Campari and tangerine juice.
Yeah, nice. It's delicious. Served in a martini glass.
Or on the rocks, depending on how you
feel. The group we met with and are in with a salted rim is called Femme Fatale.
That's a different drink.
Let's do a shout out for Femme Fatale.
Yeah, Femme Fatale is this fantastic group out of New York that's a grassroots group that gets together of
women directors. Yeah.
It is interesting in all seriousness that it took two women stepping forward and saying, we're doing this, to maybe kind of coalesce a community that there are various groups, there yeah. are various people doing individual things. But I think that the launch of Tangerine really kind of helped pull people together, seems like.
I mean, I think so. We've also tried to be very community oriented and sort of right. have fun with it. You know, it's kind of a
we
fun
want to make
name
it and fun. And like we love action points. So we don't we like, you know, we're happy to talk about it, but we're like, okay, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? Small or big? Let's talk to these people. Maybe they'll do something with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, and we get asked to speak a lot about mm-hmm. what's wrong with the industry. Why aren't there more women? And we just don't like to dwell on that. I mean, I don't really like to get into, you know, what's wrong and what the reasons are or whatever. It's just, it's happening. It happens in a lot of fields. And so we'd rather just do something about it and, mm-hmm. and sort of put our money where our mouth is. And yeah, that was important to us. And I do think because of the way that we're doing it and because we're trying to make people feel so included, mm-hmm. There has been a fantastic response. A little bit, I mean, kind of more than we expected.
really?
Yeah, we feel a really big responsibility that I didn't think we thought we would feel.
Well, folks that are listening now and want to find out more about the company, how can they send you their digital script? How can they find out more about what you do?
We're very Googleable. You can do that. Liking us on Facebook is fantastic, or following us in any social media is great. We have a very basic website.
If you want all the basic information is on the website,
yep.
just tangerineentertainment.com.
Or tangent.com, tangent. Yeah, we would love to hear from people, but
web,
we really only want to take a quick two-page synopsis or a lookbook.
Okay. Well, that's important to say.
I have to get that out there.
Yeah.
Don't send the script. Send a synopsis. The company is Tangerine. The founders are Anne Hubble and Amy Hobby. Thank you for being on The Daily Buzz.
Yeah.
Thanks, Eugene.
Wrapping up another edition of The Daily Buzz, this is Eugene Hernandez at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Our show is produced by Irene Cho in association with the Film Society of Lincoln Center. Thank you to our hosts this week, Microsoft's 1 million square foot lounge on Main Street and the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main Street. Thank you to our sponsors, Soyombo, Sabra, Skullcandy, and Cloud Electronics. The Daily Buzz is available at KCPW and KCPW.org, FilmLink.com, and on iTunes.